All right, listeners, now you go easy on Nick Mays and Master Control tonight because we're going to get your blood pressure up. Yes, it is a tragic anniversary today, and it has been repeated ad nauseum ad infinitum. It is the 17th anniversary of the shootings at the École Polytechnique. The reason it is nauseating is because we in this country have a tendency, every time there's any kind of a tragedy, to engage immediately in gratuitous regulation, gratuitous cannibalism of a sector of society, whether it be men in general or an industry or anything that causes one freak event. And suddenly, we're burdened again with thousands of bureaucrats, hundreds of regulations as politicians scramble in an effort to show the public that we're doing something, to put something in the next flyer for the next election. It's really enough, because this country is becoming unlivable. It's not about sustainable development, as Stéphane Dion has said. It's about sustainable living. We're choking on our own laws. In this nation, the population of California, three levels of government, last year alone, which was average, 15,000 pieces of legislation and regulation were either enacted new to meet some perceived problem in society, not even tragic as the École Polytechnique shootings, any problem, or were revised. You've got to break five laws between getting up in the morning and going to work. Ça suffit. It's enough. Nobody has to have this guilt and this burden and the silliness of thinking that everything in life can be controlled. You know, years ago, my generation came to maturity when Prime Minister Trudeau said the government has no place in the bedrooms of the nation. Well, he didn't just mean it that way. What he meant, as he explained in his writings, is the government has no role regulating every action of human beings. Not everything is going to be perfect in life. Not every problem can be solved. No politician should pretend it can and be allowed to put into force straitjacket law that seeks to micromanage every aspect of our lives. Those who do should be exposed for what they truly are, unimaginative and cowardly functionaries staggering from election to election, fearful of tackling any vested interest to do the really work on the really important issues necessary for the public good, and they hope to create some body of work for fodder for election time publicity. As Tacitus wrote, when the state is most impotent, the laws are most multiplied. And Canada's political elite can truly be called the new prohibitionists, at least until this government was elected in Ottawa. And not just the political elite, but the citizenry of Canada. Our national mentality is a new prohibitionist mentality. To paraphrase writer Anne Hingston, the Canadian mentality now is restrict first, discuss never. And with a new prohibitionist share is an anti-liberal sentiment because they seek to curtail basic liberties of natural law that's the patrimony of every human being, or demonize segments of society that shouldn't be demonized, or they seek to elevate and regulate one group of society over another. Prime Minister Harper has been criticized for shutting down 14 of 18 status of women centers. The status of women right now is stronger than the status of men. And besides that, that shouldn't be a role for government either. Politicians get away with it. They got away with it because Canadians have surrendered to the sovereignty of self-abnegation in all things. We become a people plagued by a self-doubt driven by a jealousy of other self-belief. In the process, we've created a self-imposed tyranny that mutes individual integrity and conscience and trades them for a false security. False security demanded by state-sponsored bureaucratic consensus. And not of this kind of a violent anniversary to celebrate today. The murders, the killings of the four RCMP officers last year led to more calls about drug laws. That's not the issue. That doesn't solve anything. It doesn't solve anything that because somebody's kid fell off a bike and hurt his head, then in Ontario they now have laws that are with $200 penalties if you don't wear a helmet when you're riding a bicycle. Or that Jerry Kennedy ran for the Liberal leadership, decided to make it almost criminal for parents who don't force their kids to stay in school till they're 18. You can't legislate everything. if you take away the passion in our life, if you take away that in life that is not straight, that cannot be categorized and pigeonholed, what do you have? Where is our art? Where is our poetry? Where is our music? Our lives would be the worse for it, devoid of passion or purpose. Government's role must be one of persuasion and education, not compulsion and coercion. No matter how odious an event was, and no matter how egregious a citizen's personal habit may be, the dark side of our governors, and certainly the left-leaning part, is that they engage in unbridled intervention in matters of private domain to punish the government, the governed, into virtuous conduct. But legislators generally don't know what's right for us. They barely know what's right for themselves. The role of the state has to be to protect us from each other, not from ourselves and from every eventuality. Algernon Swinburne, British poet, had a wonderful three lines on this. Change in a trice the lilies and languors of virtue for the raptures and roses of vice. And we're going to be discussing that this evening. Just how much more can we take? Or should we say, hey, state, stay out of our fate? We'll be back with our first guest, Barbara Cain, right after this. And tonight we're going to take on some of the last sacred cows. Are you tired of feeling guilt-ridden every time there's an anniversary of a tragedy? Are you being pushed around by stupid rule and regulation to perfect, quote-unquote, your lives? Well, if you are, call in, because we want to hear from you, because we're sick and tired of it. And our next guest certainly is sick and tired of it. The Montreal Massacre Commemoration Industry, whose emotive effect depends on supporting men, is having the opposite effect. For the sins of a few, the nature of half our polity is often falsely maligned, breeding suspicion and hostility, needless shame and guilt, and mutual resentment and mistrust. Barbara Kay, National Post columnist, them's fighting words. I had some joy this morning that there's some reason out there.
Well, that's great.
It's a sad thing. It's a terrible thing, the massacre. But really, what is it about Canada that every single time anything happens, from little Johnny falling off his bike to a tragedy like this, we've got rules, regulations, commemorations, guilt, neuroses, psychoses? I mean, is this whole country being run by therapists?
Well, you might say yes. Partly it's being run by therapists. And that when it's not being run by therapists, it's being run by feminists. But I'd like to just correct one impression you may be giving, that anything is up for grabs in terms of creating regulations and criticisms on a collective level, because this is a very politically correct country. You could not have taken the Montreal Massacre if that crime had been committed, say, by a Jamaican black man, and you would not have extrapolated from it the kinds of general critique that was allowed to be attributed to men,
right,
in general. So, there are certain groups that are sacrosanct. We don't touch them. We don't try to regulate them. But when it comes to certain other groups, like men in general, and particularly when a crime is committed by, a white guy, although, in fact, Marc Lépine was half Algerian. But
that's right.
Never mind, we won't go there, because that wasn't the theme of what I was criticizing. And yes, the statism is one part of it, but the other part is this tendency to do a guilt trip about something that is not actually a pattern. There is no pattern of anti-female hatred in our culture. There is in some other cultures, because this is a culturally revved up syndrome. But it is not present in our culture. In fact, the opposite tendency. And yet, when I say the word industry, I mean that particular crime then got ratcheted up and cranked up into a, isn't this awful? Look at the hostility to women. We need more shelters. We need more money. We need more committees.
You know, it's this committee thing. And you know what? Yeah. I get pissed off as a guy. How come that crime suddenly wiped all men with the same, tarred all men with the same brush? What are we? We all beat up women and hate them drag them down the street?
Yeah, not that you're going to do it, but part of feminist, a big part of feminist theory is that men are by nature violent or wishing to be violent, and they are misogynistic. They really want control over women. That's part of the kind of gestalt that feminist theory, you know, contributes to the social debate. And
I wonder if Gloria Steinem says that to Mort Zuckerman when they're over dinner.
There are certain exceptions, I suppose. But the thing is, and maybe on a personal level, most feminists wouldn't agree with that about their particular boyfriend or their particular husband or their son, but they are very much comfortable with the notion that men are inherently women-hating, being spread through the schools, through curricula, as you said, not just committees, but the White Ribbon Movement that was, by the way, co-founded by Jack Layton in 1991 as a direct response to the massacre, took as its mandate to educate Canadians. And so established a curriculum, feminist-guided, which is now present in, 2 years ago it was in 100 schools. I don't know how many schools it's in now. And the message is that children are trained to look at this Montreal massacre as somehow a lens through which they perceive the broader culture. Is that healthy? Is that wholesome to tar with one brush half our citizenry? I think it's disgraceful.
It's not only disgraceful, it's factually, you know, it's factually untrue to begin with, but it's this self-abnegation that I talked about. It's almost as if Canadians, men or women, want to beat themselves up over anything. They're longing, they're looking for things. You know, Quebec had 96,000 cases reported of domestic violence. Well, a good, healthy, for 30% of that was women hitting their spouses.
I think the figure is probably higher, but men are ashamed to report violence perpetrated on them by women because it's unmanly, whereas women are much more likely to admit to violence. But the thing is, never mind what the stats are, the point is that women also, you're right, women do commit violence, but that's not part of the message that comes out of this massacre. The message is all women are potential victims, all men are potential deliverers of violence.
Victimizers. We all have to be demonized, of course.
Yes.
And that's and I want to get to this right after the break that I'm being motioned to furiously that we have to go to, that it leads to insane laws like Section 143 of our labor code that is now used by female employees for psychological harassment, where you could sue your employer or your superior because he used bad language, mm-hmm. that was passed in Quebec last year. We'll be right back with Barbara Kay, The National Post. And we're talking about excessive statism in Canada, but more specifically, you know, trying to say, maybe it's time to tell government, hey, state, stay out of our fate. It is the 17th anniversary of the École Polytechnique massacre, but as our guest Barbara Kay of the National Post wrote today, it was a freak tragedy. But unfortunately, as often happens in this country, every time there's an incident, a tragic incident even, all of a sudden we get rule and regulation, and as she put it, committees and studies and guilt and all kinds of nonsense. And Barbara, you point out one absurd parallel that was made by, as you called her, career arch feminist Judy Rebeck, who said that if Lapine had killed 14 Jews, he'd have been seen as anti-Semitic. And your comment, yes, and rightly so, because anti-Semitism is a historical syndrome involving a litany of actual massacres. It's also something else, I might point out. 13 Jews do it just by looking at people. You got to know who they are. This guy goes up into a tower, starts shooting at people. When Charles Starkweather did it at the University of Texas in the 1960s, and most of the 20 people he killed were women, nobody screamed that this is kind of a tragedy that requires an examination of all men in American society. It was a tragedy. He was imprisoned, and there was a cult movie called Natural Born Killers made out of it. They don't have this angst. How come Americans are more self-reliant and independent?
No,
than these
I'm
things?
Not sure that it's an American thing. I'm going to keep coming back to the fact that it's a feminist thing, because I'll give you another example that
sure.
supports my claim, and that is the shooting in Dunblane, Scotland, when the guy came in and killed 15 children.
Right.
Now, that was a horrible tragedy, but nobody extrapolated from that incident the fact that all men hate children. It's just not true, because feminists know that more women kill their children than men under the age of 5. So it's
because... And we have that case in Texas of the mother who killed, what, 3 of her children?
5.
5.
But the thing is that it's only when it's a man who singles out women. But by the way, this particular gender side is a total one-off. There's not before and not after. There have been female children singled out by pedophiles. The Amish case, the guy singled out, but he let the adult women go. So you can't call that a gendercide. That was that had to do with a pedophilic, you know, this mental disturbance. But this, if there were widespread hostility to women amongst men in our culture, this would not be the only time that this happened. So what I'm saying is they have tried to make from one incident a generalization that is, and Rebic's comment about Jews is particularly shameful because anti-Semitism is a known pattern and a collective hatred that has absolutely nothing to do with individual acts of violence against women, and certainly not with this particular E. coli thing.
You make another very important point, that honoring the dead from any situation should draw a country together.
Yes.
It should create a stronger sense of national purpose, not a stronger sense of not national guilt, but in this case gender guilt or group-specific guilt, to the point where we begin to question every single initiative that we as a nation can do. Is that one of the results of overemphasizing these kind of commemorations and these kind of incidents, that we second guess and third guess everything we do?
It's a result partly of multiculturalism and allowing special interest groups to make claims on government funding and on government intervention. What you said before, and I'm glad you emphasized that from my column, is that all government-funded ceremonies should have the entire jurisdiction in mind. In other words, all Canadians, and otherwise they shouldn't fund it. They shouldn't be funding something that is divisive. And this constant, these vigils, these annual vigils, are not healing. They actually open wounds between men and women. They are unhealthy. It is unwholesome what this is promoting. And I agree that the government is guilty because they've allowed themselves to be dragged into this politically correct. They have not sought it out. And it's kind of relativistically, they've put it in the nature of as if it was like a Holocaust memorial, Lahavdil, as we say in our culture.
Yep. You know, I remember a time not too long ago when we were trying to define Canadianism and trying to define a Canadian will. But as time went on, particularly the past 13 years until the change of government this year, we had such an elevation, I'm referring back to a point you just made, such an elevation both of religious sacrament to secular right and parochial particularities to political demand and justification, that we've lost all sense and semblance of the horizon of what it means to be a Canadian. There is nothing universal being celebrated in this country.
I so agree, and I think this is one more excellent example of how the government tends to go with a minority, or no, this isn't a minority, women are not a minority.
No, you control 52% of the bank accounts, by the way.
To cave in to one group's demand and forsake half the population, because that's really what the government did. It's saying, well, men's feelings are expendable. Women have to be satisfied. The feminists have to be satisfied. They have so much power in government and at elite cultural levels that I find it very unhealthy.
And I think the end of your article, and I recommend to everybody, go to the websites, pick up the National Post if you don't have it. This is something to think about. This whole problem, you write, is something for Canadian, quote, equality buffs to ponder at the vigil tonight. And your colleague George Jonas once wrote that the problem in Canada is we've gone beyond equality. We now have demands for parity, and that is going to paralyze this nation. Barbara Kay, many, many thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thanks very much, Montreal. We'll be back after the news. And for cell phone users, *940 on for Rogers, #940 for Bell. And today we're taking on the state. Hey, state, stay out of our fate. First half hour, we looked at the sociological implications of the Canadian reaction to anything that goes wrong. We legislate, we regulate, we restrict first, discuss never, we demonize. We're talking, it is the 70th anniversary of the Élie Capot Technique shooting, and it's a terrible thing. But it shouldn't have led to the commissions and the demonization of men and all this national angst. But it goes further than that. Every time something happens, national rights are restricted. In Ontario, a friend of Minister of Health Information, there's an Orwellian name for you, Jim Watson, son, one of his friend's sons, hurt himself falling off a bicycle. Boom. laws are passed that require you to wear a helmet when you're on a bicycle running around your suburban subdivision. Kennedy, Watson's colleague, as Minister of Education, passed a law making it almost a criminal offense for parents whose children leave school before they're 18. In Quebec, Section 143 is introduced in the Labor Code, psychological harassment, where an employee can take any employer or superior to a tribunal without witnesses, even for the use of bad language that emotionally stresses them. There's threat in an insecure world of terror. What's our reaction? A Liberal justice bill last November carried over parts of it into the Tory justice bill now, calling for internet telephony and email oversight and the turning over of some files at a time to state security authorities without probable cause. It's enough. Anti-smoking law regulators, inspectors walk into your offices to do snap inspections, and then they tell you that they have a right to look in the drawers of your desk. And when you ask them why, Section 33 of the Act. Well, what about Section 7 of the Quebec Charter of Rights and Freedoms that guarantees your privacy? It's enough. Federal government makes noise about decriminalizing marijuana. At the same time, again, under the former Liberal government, proposed to give the police unlimited powers to stop drivers for random drug checks in their cars. In Montreal, street-level cameras on St. Denis Street, now on St. Lawrence Street, ostensibly, to stop drug trafficking, never get erased. We're very glad to have with us one of the few storehouses of reason and sanity left in this country on the issue of our rights and our civil liberties and our individual consequence. Canada's leading civil liberties attorney, constitutional expert, Julius Gray. Julius, welcome, and thank you for joining us tonight.
It's a pleasure. Always a pleasure to hear you.
Julius, in our salad days, we're still in our salad days, the hell with it. Be a song, how low can it go? How far can this statism go?
Well, you see, what I find is that we are statist where we shouldn't be, and we're not statist where we should be. We're deregulating the economy, we're destroying the security of workers, we're doing all sorts of things by cutting taxes irresponsibly and so on that we shouldn't be doing, and then we are regulating our private life, our everyday reactions and so on. How far can it go?
Is it not because Canadians are willing to give up almost anything if you tell them it's for your security?
But I don't think it's Canadians alone. It's Americans too, in a different way. More security hysteria if the person is called Muhammad, perhaps a little less on some of the Canadian niceness. What Canada likes to do is legislate niceness, and in the name of niceness, you can have a very oppressive society. If you're not nice, you're going to be oppressed. If you use bad language, you're going to be seriously oppressed. But everybody knows that the real evil is not somebody who's a little rough or who's a little gruff. Real evil is somebody who might be very smooth. You know, Shakespeare was great at that. Iago, Edmund, these are guys who appeared to be very nice and sweet. And in Canada, our desire to legislate niceness means we're prepared to repress anybody who is very eccentric, politically incorrect, gruff,
frank. Repression, of course, is still considered nice.
Exactly. You see, there was a young Cuban whom I met who told me when he was in Cuba, he thought he didn't have freedom of expression because you couldn't say down with Fidel.
Right.
Then he came to Canada, and he found he had even less freedom of expression because in Cuba you could do just about anything else except say down with Fidel.
Right.
You could make a dirty joke.
You could smoke where you like.
Somebody.
You could pick up a girl.
You could do all sorts of things. You could pinch somebody, which is not something that you'd praise.
Of course, I wouldn't do that, but you could do that.
But it's not something you'd praise. But the problem is that in Canada, the question, you can't say this because so-and-so will be offended. You can't say this because so-and-so will be offended. So, in fact, the actual
everyday living
of freedom was less because of niceness, because of legislating.
Julius, I'll ask you to be nice and be patient with me because the lines are really burning up and I want to relieve some pressure. Al, good evening. You're on with Julius Gray.
Yeah, I'm a firearms instructor for the government. I've been doing this for about 14 years.
Right.
In the books which we issued to the students, there's statistics compiled from 1985 to 95 when the books were printed up. The stats in there state that over a 10-year period, 23% of the homicides across Canada were created by firearms. The other 77% were by other means. Isn't it logical to assume if the firearms were not present, that the those who achieved the homicide with, 77% had the firearms not been available, surely they would have, used the same means.
Many of them.
It's not the firearms. It's rage.
Well, Al, I'll give you a better statistic that's across the country and, in fact, across the continent. 86% of all homicides are committed by people who know each other, and half of them are domestic.
And another thing that I'd want to add is that murder of all crimes is the one least likely to be repeated. I'm not speaking of hired killers who kill repeatedly.
Right.
But most cases, murder is a one-time crime. It is not necessary to send somebody away for life and throw away the key. There is, of course, a very serious punishment that must be imposed. But it's not likely that a man who's killed in a particular situation, as the caller said, of rage, is going to do it again.
Gentlemen, I would ask you to be patient with me because I'm about to be killed if I don't take this break so we can pay some bills. We'll be right back with Julius Gray. And you can email us your comments at info@iapm.ca after the show, and we're talking about, hey, state, stay out of our fate. Let's end the new prohibitionism. Julius Gray, Canada's leading civil liberties and constitutional attorney, is on with us. It's wonderful to make mistakes in life. Today, there are so many laws regulating everything. You not only can't make mistakes and learn some self-reliance, frankly, if ignorance is no excuse in front of the law, then I'm a little befuddled because you're a genius. I'm not, and I know I break 5 laws getting to work in the morning.
I know I've broken laws, and one of the problems is that in the old days, people could forget. Today, with internet and everything, if you get convicted of the slightest things, your life is seriously affected. You can never get over it. You can employers will find out about it 20 years later, no matter how many pardons you get. We have the what I call the democratic smugness. Because we are a democracy, the judge has necessarily found you guilty for a good reason, and therefore you were guilty and you deserve to be cast out. And if we're going to promote somebody to a civil service position, etc., it has to be somebody who hasn't done it, because there's always somebody else who hasn't been caught or who has been lucky and who's talked his way out of it. As a result, any minor conviction which can happen to any one of us means a serious impediment. I'm not telling you your life is totally over for something of that sort. But it nevertheless, every time I deal with people accused of minor offenses, I tell them, this is very, very serious, because any conviction, unless you get a discharge, and even then, is going to be a very, very, very serious blot on your record, and it's hard to get over it.
Oh, yeah. There was a fellow in town, a businessman in town, several years ago, this story just jumps to mind, who was the victim of a sting operation, joint RCMP FBI. They got the wrong guy. Last name, wrong first name.
Yeah.
His arrest appeared on page 1 of the Gazette. The FBI RCMP apology, 4 weeks later, appeared on page 6.
Yeah, it was one of the strange things is that after Arar and everything else that we've seen, most citizens are still convinced, because they believe so strongly in our democratic institutions, that if the police suspected you, you must be guilty. They just didn't find the evidence. If you were accused, you must absolutely be guilty, because the Crown can't be wrong.
That astonishes me, that more Canadians don't understand that we live in a quasi-democracy. They don't have a pure, direct right to elect anybody. Things are done behind closed doors. It's order and council government, and they really think that there are no vested interests, nor strong and free.
Our society, although less so than many other democratic countries, our society is very corrupt, less so than others. But the corruption is general, and every so often, when it comes to the fore, we sacrifice 3 or 4 people. Sacrifice Mr. Coffin. Perhaps Mr. Black will be sacrificed on the altar of honesty. But 90% of the people are involved in this, and it's
they get to go home and feel smug and wonderful.
All the people who deal in cash and so on, and yet they are more than willing to jump up and down with anger if somebody gets a conditional sentence or if somebody is released a little early.
Oh, sure. You reminded me just now when you mentioned Conor Black. Diane Francis, the economist, wrote a book called Underground Nation, which she statistically makes the case that almost 50% of Canadians are working to some extent for cash. So, you know, you could see all these little Lilliputians jumping up and down when there's a new Vestal Virgin, in quotations, to be sacrificed to the gods of niceness, as you put it. And then they go home smug and comfy and feel that they're really good and virtuous a nation.
So the fault in Canada, there's surely a certain degree of smugness and hypocrisy. The fault in the United States is a great roughness and a willingness to be harsh, which is worse, I think.
Yeah,
I mean, I
understand your point. You get the dear prisoner letter from IRS real quick in the States.
Yeah, no, the United States is a society which is, in all sorts of ways, a very rough society with a number of people who are not insured and so on. But Canada should not be proud of its political correctness, of the snuffing out of opposition by the requirement of niceness and by the various lobbies, each of which requires that you be absolutely nice to it, even though it doesn't have a reciprocal duty towards you. And if you make a mistake, there is no forgiveness. If you insult somebody, then, of course, you are always evil and you have to be cast out. Go to the wrong place and make a Muhammad or a chosen people or a crucifixion joke, and you are in serious trouble.
And, you know, a lot of this extends to things that we don't even think about. Niceness is part of it. Legislating virtue is part of it. But it leads so quickly and inevitably into invasions of our most basic right, what Justice Louis Brandeis called them, the right most prized in civilized nations, that right of privacy. You know, we had a case the other day where a young lady had been receiving welfare for a certain amount of time. And this is just one example of invasion of privacy. And she'd had some help from some family members and reported it. And some bureaucrat didn't catch it. So now, like 4 years later, they're asking a sum of money back. But that's not the point. The point is they walked into her bank, and her bank gave over all her records without advising her.
Well, because we are all convinced that our government and our system is perfect. But, you know, one of the problems with the invasion of privacy is an objective one, technology. It's very, very difficult. You see, the reason why I believe that Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union terrorized people all the time is because they really had no way of following them. If you and I met for dinner,
right,
and we said some unorthodox things, and well, you or I would have been in trouble in Berlin, but say in Moscow, we said some unorthodox
right
things. If they didn't overhear us, they'd never find out about
correct
it. Whereas today, they can overhear.
From 100
record,
feet away.
Record and keep records, find out from all sorts of people. As a result, they don't have to terrorize in quite the same brutal ways, but the loss of freedom is the same. And the example is the intermediate stage, East Germany and the Stasi.
Mm-hmm.
East Germany kept taking records. They were not terrorizing people in the 80s in the same way Stalin was. Nobody was disappearing. In fact, you might have had a prestigious position in an East German university, and you didn't know that they had a file on you that spread from the Baltic right down to the southern border.
Julius, please stay with us for one more question that I have for you to round out this discussion. We're just going to take a very, very quick break right now.
All right.
And we've been talking tonight about the state. Hey, state, stay out of our fate. The self-abnegation of the new prohibitionists. The writer Ann Hingston said that Canada's problem is we restrict first, we discuss never. Julius Gray, is the solution that there's too much law, too little justice, and we've got to start rolling the state out of areas of jurisdiction where people's personal lives are involved and nobody else is hurt?
Yes, I think that's the case, but I think we also have to remember that it's a very difficult task.
Why?
And to do this, we have to, because...
But why?
Because we are so... we have so little moral passion. We have to change to some extent and really believe in privacy, in individual
rights.
But
not just believe in that, but believe in ourselves to conduct our lives.
That's right, but also believe... we also have to learn how to forgive. One of the reasons that makes it so profitable and so useful to keep data and invade people is because our society doesn't forgive. If we forgave, if people came up and said, you know, here's what I've discovered about somebody, and the answer of most people were, so what? People wouldn't spend their time tracking other people's individuals.
But you and I grew up at a time of so what? What,
yes,
what happened in the
we
past 20, 25
Margaret
years?
Margaret Trudeau's amorous adventures were never reported on until she herself published a book.
Well, except for that one famous picture in the airport after the Rolling Stones party.
But that was, generally speaking, the right attitude to take. What we have to adopt is a more forgiving attitude. We have to accept that somebody who's done something at 20, for instance, you know, one of the most monstrous things was the case of Mr. Serrien, who was removed 30 years later after an exemplary career because of something he had done at 20. We have to have a society which is capable of forgiving, capable of saying this is finished now. Of seeing that a person who has made a mistake can nevertheless be a much better person morally than somebody who's always been very careful and hedged his bets and never got into trouble. So it's a difficult thing to do. Yes, we have to change. We have to stress the deregulate those areas, the non-economic areas of our society, but we also have to get a certain moral ardor about forgiveness, decency, fraternity, if you like, mm-hmm. so that people will not find it so useful to collect unpleasant data about their neighbors.
In other words, we may not be such a good and gentle Northern Dominion. We may just be a petty little land of Lilliputians.
In other words, legislating niceness may not be very nice.
Julius Gray, many thanks for your wisdom, as always.
It's a pleasure.
And that is the bottom line. Legislating niceness is not only not very nice, it's damned wrong, it's damned counterproductive, it sucks the juice out of national character. It creates a very boring and feckless and fey citizenry. And let's go away from this hour a little bit ticked off. Go away from this hour guiltless. Go away from this hour being proud of your passions. Go away from this hour understanding it's okay to swear. It's okay to let loose. Without those passions, where would we be without Modigliani's art? There would not be Hemingway's literature. We would be a dry and brittle and parched people, and that is what we were becoming. Vice has its place. The great writer Samuel Butler said, it is the function of it, the function of vice, to keep virtue within reasonable bounds. Well, Canadian virtue may be extending all reasonable bounds. Good night, everybody. We'll be back with you tomorrow night. Thank you to Nick Mays, the Master Control.